You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. I'm Yaz Rana and today I'm joined by former England batsman Mark Butcher, the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. We've got plenty lined up in today's show, another excellent round of the County Championship, the IPL suspension, some other bits and bobs from the world of international cricket, as well as Phil's fascinating conversation with Graham Gooch. But let's start with the Championship, and I think the most exciting bit of Championship news was actually broken by Ben yesterday. The story that the Middlesex Gloucestershire game, this will be shown in its entirety on Sky Sports Cricket in the UK in the absence of the IPL. Ben, do you want to explain what's happening and for our non-UK listeners and viewers, why that's exciting for English fans?
Obviously it's not hugely out of the ordinary for the County Championship to be shown on Sky. It does happen every so often that they remember that there's a domestic Red Bull competition that's pretty good to watch sometimes. This has happened fortuitously because of the IPL being cancelled. I guess it's the one benefit of that. And it's also, I think, just a massive tick in the box for Middlesex and the quality of their live stream. They've put quite a lot of investment into it. They've got, I think, three manned cameras, and they're going to add a fourth manned camera for this stream. They're also, I think, one of the few counties, possibly the only county this season, to have like a bespoke commentary team. So have to have a sort of TV style commentary on top of their footage rather than taking the radio thing, which makes it a much better watch. And they've also just got a crack team of commentators so far. So Adam Collins and Izzy Westbury are both recent winners of the Chris Mark and Jenkins Domestic Broadcaster of the Year Award. And Matt Floyd is obviously, people will recognise him from his work on Sky. So it's been a really high quality production. And I think the biggest, it's Sky just taking their feed. They're not coming down with their set of cameramen and that sort of thing. They're just taking them to, they're going to add some commentators. So I think Atherton, Ward, Key and Hussain will all be there, the big four. It should just be a great watch. And it will still be available on Middlesex's YouTube as well. So no one's losing out, just be a bit more oxygen for the game. And I think hopefully this might encourage other counties that if they put the same investment in, they might get the same sort of publicity and feedback in return, I guess.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to what happens the next month as well after this round of games. Do they use other county streams or, yeah, that'll be interesting to see. We've got a question from one of our listeners. Anik asked, would you be happy if a streaming service like Amazon Prime got rights to the county championship or keep it free on YouTube as it is now? I think it's optimistic that Amazon Prime get their wallet out for the county championship, but you never know. Phil Butch, any thoughts? Do you quite like it how it is?
We have to take the wins when they come, first of all. We've got to remember that not too long ago, streaming county cricket, watching county cricket digitally was a pipe dream. And the game was sort of, you know, ruggedly stuck in the past, really. And what we're seeing now, slowly but surely, is the game being opened up now to new audiences. And they are being reminded, as Ben sardonically points out, that there is actually quite a bit of value to a good Red Bull game of cricket. And look, we've discussed it for a few times now on the show, because it really is changing the whole complexion of the English game. And that's not an exaggeration. We are learning more about players on a day-by-day basis. We are getting to know their good bits and their less good bits more intimately than we've ever really known before. And it's democratizing the game in a way that just simply hasn't happened before. And it's huge. Now, Middlesex's stream is more advanced than others, and it's taken a punt with Adam and Izzy and so on, and they are quality broadcasters. And it also helps that it's North London as well. And let's be honest, you know, some of the Sky commentators, it's not a big ask. You know, they could be having a wonderful service at Chesley Street, but I wouldn't imagine that Sky would be trawling out too many commentators for that one. But look, it's a sign of progress, and these signs are coming thick and fast at the moment, and it's great for the game.
Can I just, on the Amazon Prime point, it's possibly unrealistic that Amazon Prime will come in. I would love to see serious discussions made by the 18 counties between themselves for launching their own platform, where they sort of combine all their streams and perhaps even put a bit of money behind someone to sort of front the whole thing. I suggest something around that when there was a very exciting last round of the T20 Blast last year, and it was quite hard to follow, but hugely exciting. And if there had been someone sort of like pointing you in, here's where this exciting thing is happening, here's where this exciting thing is happening, and possibly even cutting between the games, that would be great. And I can see that kind of thing happening for the county. I don't think the counties own the rights to their streams. I think Sky own the rights, which is why they can just step in and sort of say, we're streaming this one. So that would be possibly for the next right cycle. But at some point, I can see that being possibly a little money spinner for the counties, and definitely something which helps to bring the game to like a wider audience.
Mm. I find it amazing that not that long ago, we're going to talk about Matt Parkinson later on, and some of the deliveries he's bowled this season have been amazing. But not that long ago, if somebody produced something like that in a game of county cricket, no one would see it.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's that's hundreds of years worth of that. And that's why the cricket writers were always so important. We know what's kind of been happening there in terms of the sort of accessibility that or at least the coverage that the newspapers are willing to give the county game. So as that has diminished, the stream is now stepping up. You know, and people would, I'm sure, would prefer to be able to see the thing live rather than read the beautiful words of somebody like Phil writing about them. No, actually, that can't be true.
Come on.
But you know, so that's, you know, one thing is sort of replacing the other. This stream of this game going on Sky is replacing the IPL. Had the IPL not been cancelled, this would not be happening. And the first view of sort of county cricket this summer would have been the Middlesex-Surrey game, starting on the 20th of May, which is, you know, full Sky outside broadcast, etc. So, yeah, it's all good. Listen, anything that pleases the county cricket fan and allows people to sit there and watch is a very, very fine thing. You know, and the county players is actually interesting, because you kind of, you know, you always felt a little bit like you were, whatever you did, good or bad, was kind of hidden away. You know, you didn't have to quite be on your best behaviour. It wasn't like playing a one day international or even playing a blast game, you know, on Sky in the evenings. And now that is not the case. You know, players are finding out that little bits of skullduggery are being picked up on, et cetera, et cetera.
But you've also got the
added sort of, you'd mentioned some things going on in the T20. One of my arguments against the T20 blast in the way that we've always done it, i.e. with 18 teams and, you know, everybody pretty much playing all of the time, is that whatever you did, you couldn't keep up with it. You know, the example that I would always give when I was having arguments with people around the idea that having fewer teams in a different type of competition might not be such a bad idea. I hadn't dreamt up the 100, mind you. You know, that's a separate sort of issue. I was still talking about T20. But the example I would often give was of when Somerset spent all that cash on Chris Gayle coming over, who played four games or something, made a couple of hundreds, you know, just battering the ball to death. But nobody saw it. You know, Sky's games were always elsewhere. You know, you have to roll the dice a little bit, and you pick whatever you think the game might be good. You even look at where the truck is, because don't forget, we'd do games from the pod, the guys would drive the pod through the night up in Durham. They'd drive it through the night to go down and set up at Taunton for a game the next day. I mean, that's how it would work. There'd be one set of kit, and we would follow a, you know, zigzag around the country. So sometimes you were just unlucky. You missed the great performances. You missed the water cooler moments, and that was one of the things that I always felt was an issue in terms of huge outlay being made for these great players, and yet it's not part of the national conversation because no one can see it. 6,000 people at Taunton saw it, and nobody else. You know, it might as well not have happened. So, and that's not, sorry, I'm not having a go at Taunton, one of the great sort of county setups that there is. But that was the fact of the matter. So the streaming thing is, of course, very welcome. Yeah.
I'm itching to talk about Matt Parkinson, but it just makes this a huge game for some of those Gloucestershire players who have done a lot to advance their cases in recent years. So, I mean, specifically, James Bracey and Chris Denton, and to a slightly lesser extent Ryan Higgins. I mean, obviously people would have been able to watch on the live stream, but the fact that you'll have Atherton and Hussein commentating on them, you know, if Chris Dent goes out and sort of, like, you know, blocks out and really blunts Tim Merton, Toby Rowland Jones to get to a gritty half century, and they're talking about him and saying, like, yeah, I can see how he's doing this on a, you know, in a test match ground against a test class attack, that can be a huge thing for pushing their case forward. And, you know, Gloucestershire are kind of one the county sort of complain a little bit that, you know, we have these class players, they're not talked about as much. Well, this is a real chance to be in the shop window and to show what they can do.
Also, Butch, I had a question for you on this, actually. So last week we talked about, like, how much opportunities the England coach gets to watch county cricket. And I guess same question really goes for, like, the Sky commentators quite a lot, the guys who do the test stuff. They don't get an opportunity to watch a lot of it.
No.
So actually, if you are a Gloucester player who's doing quite well at the moment, this is a really good opportunity to impress players, people in the world of cricket whose opinion carries a lot of weight.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, and this, you know, this is sort of a chat about the wider problems or the wider good of the county game. It's great that you have 18 teams playing. It's great that you have this sort of this wide coverage around the UK. I mean, you know, if you look at it, I suppose even the 18 counties don't cover all of the cricket that's played in the country, you know, minor counties, et cetera, et cetera. There are lots of hubs of the game that are not represented by a first-class team. And so it does make it, on the one hand, it's brilliant because you've got all of these players playing and you've got, a lot of the population has some access to it. But it's also incredibly difficult to know who's any good, you know, because you have that many players playing at any one time. And I think I've mentioned this before. Guys are always going to, there are going to be some blokes who are in great form and some blokes who are not, and that doesn't always tell you the story as to who is a better player. You know, you just, when you're playing that many games over that wider a scope, form and class are not always the same thing. So yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. And I think, you know, I was talking to Mark Lane earlier on this week about Gloucester's star and everything, and he was waxing lyrical about the new system. So moving away from the streaming a little bit, but about the, you know, being able to play shop window type cricket in his group of group two that they're in, play against teams that they might not have played against. I know they were promoted a couple of years back and would have done, etc., etc. But you know, there's a feeling now that all of the counties are kind of in with an equal chance to show that they have players who are worthy of being picked. And that has not been the case ever since the second division's come about. And you also think about it from this point, that Division 1, Division 2 promoted the idea that players needed to leave small clubs to go to bigger ones, right? In order to fulfil their dream of playing for England, or to put themselves in the shop window of playing for England. Championship, 2 Division County Cricket did that right from the very off. You saw this idea, you know, the talent would move towards clubs that were bigger, more first division friendly, whatever it was. No need for that anymore. Gloucestershire can keep hold of players like Dent and Higgins, and these guys can actually start to make a name for themselves without having to think, well, if I'm gonna go any further, I've got to leave. And that can only be a good thing too.
It's interesting that there is a division between certain counties who are used to Division 1 cricket, and they are a bit more ambivalent, and that's probably a polite way of putting it, about the new system. And I spoke to Anthony McGrath over the weekend, who's coach at Essex, and he said, look, from our point of view, you know, we earned the right to get into Division 1 a few years ago, and we've done well in Division 1, and And his belief and the club's belief is, well, the best should play the best. And that is very much consistent with the nature of competitive sport and the survival of the fittest and so on and so on. And I guess you can understand from a pragmatic perspective why the clubs who are in tune to Division One cricket and kind of take it almost as a birthright these days would feel like that. But from our point of view, we're not in the game for winning and losing. We're not in the game for pots. We're in the game to try and celebrate the beauty and the breadth of English cricket. And so from our point of view as journalists, I think there is a lot more openness to the system than certain counties. And there is a dividing line between, you know, those who are up there and those who have become used to Division Two. I think clubs that have got used to Division Two think this is great. This levels up, to use that awful new phrase, the competitive structure. And then there are others who are a little bit sniffier about it. But look, from my perspective, as I've said on this show a few times, I think it's great.
It's quite interesting that's what McGrath says, because a lot of Division Two clubs use Essex as the example for why the standard's actually quite there's not much of a difference in the standards. You know, Essex got promoted.
Upward mobility element of the club.
Promoted 1 year, winning it the next year. Exactly. So that is quite interesting.
But, I mean, that's an interesting, that's a kind of, you know, that's the sort of thing that you might, that fans of smaller, in inverted commas, clubs might sort of hurl at a team like Surrey, being sniffy about the idea that you have a God-given right to be in one division and to hang the rest. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Nice one, Mags.
Not even sure that was on the record.
To the cricket itself, the game of the round was Yorkshire's one-run win against Northants at Headingley. It's a remarkable game of cricket. I was watching it on the screen that you're using, Butch, with the IPL on the TV on Sunday. Northants were chasing 220 in the fourth innings, and at one point were 146 for seven before just very slowly nudging their way to the target at about two and over. They got within two runs of the target before Yorkshire skipper Stephen Patterson snared Wayne Parnell, who just kind of wafted at one without much conviction.
Having taken 10 in the match, right, Parnell?
Yeah, he had a great game. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant game.
God, cricket's and so brutal.
And he kind of looked after that run chase. He was obviously the most capable. There wasn't like a specialist batsman in to kind of lead the chase. Yeah, yeah, so it was Parnell doing that
does
job.
Does nothing for the South Africans are chokers thing, does it?
Oh, come on.
Got within one run and stuffed it up.
Well, on the side, it's not
my job to be nice to people.
Well, on South Africa doing well, Dwan Olafur bowled really well for Yorkshire, and I think Northants needed about 15 to win with two wickets in hand, and then Olafur just bounced out, I think, Kerrigan. And at that point, I thought Yorkshire would definitely win it the way he was bowling. But then, yeah, it was an amazing finish.
And also, Dane Patterson took that ridiculous catch well. Stafford's doing well. Good week for Stafford.
Yeah, we tried to speak to Patterson, actually the Yorkshire captain who took that last wicket, about that game for the podcast, but regrettably Yorkshire informed us that they are not letting any of their players speak to wisden.com or other media outlets outside of game obligations until the investigation into allegations of racism at the club, first made by Azeem Rafiq in an interview with Tahir Hashim on wisden.com, is in progress. Moving on, Butch, your moment of the week is not finally winning a game of first class cricket, which has been 3 years almost?
June 2018.
That's a very long time.
Against the mighty Essex, the mighty entitled to Division One cricket Essex. I find it very hard to believe that, you know, extraordinary that it should have taken so long that, you know, a coach like Peter Moores, who is often, not often, is always kind of lauded for the way that he's able to resurrect players' careers and has a great record. You know, you'd be hard put to find any player that has spent any time with Peter Moores who has anything but sort of glowing things to say about him. And yet, you know, in the county championship where the bread and butter is made, they have been absolutely woeful. So, yeah. Yeah, big up to the motherland. My wife and mother-in-law of Nottinghamshire, or were Nottinghamshire residents, and so they're very happy.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it improves the mood around the country when your county wins. I know this.
It's funny, actually, sorry, because I remember, actually, it's possibly in the first issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, doing a piece on Notts' revival, which would have been the end of 2017, because they'd got relegated, I think, in 2016 in quite sort of shocking circumstances, and then bounced back, tailed off slightly towards the end of that season, but it looked just like a blip when they were kind of home. I think they needed a big partnership involving Billy Root to sort of get them over line, sort of secure a draw that they kind of had no right to in the last round. And so then it was sort of like Notts are back when the big clubs in English cricket are back where they belong to be. And yes, since then have barely won a game.
Then we interviewed Ben Duckett and Joe Clark over 2 years ago now, and then when they both got signed ahead of the 2019 season, it's like, right, you know, they mean business. And
they've signed the whole England Lions
team. Yeah, exactly. It's not quite happened. There's another 100 there for Ben Slater, who's on a really good run at the moment, and there was a second innings 94 for Haseeb Hameed. And yeah, Ben's already mentioned the Dade Patterson catch on the boundary, which if you haven't seen it, do search it on the Notts Twitter feed. It's really, really good.
Are we getting to the point where it's a Samson and Delilah thing with Hameed, and we just don't cut the hair off?
Yeah. It's
all going to come tumbling down if he has a snip.
It was quite funny. There was a question on last week's show about whether Chris Silverwood's first job as selector would be to kind of decide between Lythe and Hameed, and then both were out to provide like 11:02 for Ducks on day one.
That's the game.
Yeah. Gloucester chased over 350 on the final day against Leicestershire. Ian Cobain scored a fourth innings 100 there. Just his fourth first-class game since 2017. Obviously very good in white ball cricket, but hasn't played much red ball cricket.
Well, I've got a little insider on that as well, for having spoken to Mark Alane. He says he's quite sort of confused. When you see him batting in white ball cricket, there is no confusion whatsoever. He goes out there and absolutely slams it. But Boo Boo was saying that he's, you know, just doesn't, his brain can't cope with the sort of the different demands or the different sort of pace or the different sort of thought processes around making runs in long form cricket. And he said that, you know, the fact that there was a run chase on there, time was limited, was very, very, very liberating for him.
I watched the end of that stream, and that was exactly it. It became a white ball run chase, and he was just like clearing his front leg, like, right, this guy is a brilliant striker of the ball, but it wasn't a red ball innings by the end of it. But they did, at the start, Gloucester were 52 for 3 in that run chase. So I guess they were kind of playing for the draw at the start. And then him and Tom Lace built a really good partnership, and then they were in with a sniff, and then, they took it from there.
Butler last summer in that run chase with Pakistan. When he'd been a bit garbled in his head, as he says himself, about how to go about test match cricket. And then when push came to shove and it was a last day chase, suddenly all of that clutter just fell away, and it was a clear target that he had in mind, and he played it more naturally, liberated by the situation, and since then he's gone well, obviously.
Yeah, and also on Cobain, one of the few Scouse cricketers. There aren't many of them. We've brought this up on the show before.
This kind of vacuum in Liverpool of first class cricketers.
Yeah.
His father, I think, is a Liverpool club cricket legend. I think we might have a story
That's
on
right.
him.
No, he's been in
the Club Cricket Hall of Fame. Yeah.
Amazing. Surrey got their first win of the season. They beat Group 2 pace setters Hampshire by an innings and 289 runs. Jordan Clark took career best figures of 621 on the opening day, where it looked like it was quite difficult to bat. It was quite a green pitch. A very short boundary on one side of the ground. Surrey then scored millions. There was a double ton for Hashim Amla and 100 for Ollie Pope, who now averages over 100 at the Oval in first-class cricket, before Kemal Roach took 8 for 40 to wrap up the game, which is handy. And I think if Roach hits kind of the levels we know he can reach, I think that's a huge game changer for the rest of this bit of the season.
Yeah, funny game that, because we kind of got here, saw the pitch, and was like, oh, that looks a bit green. And then Hampshire, the form team in the competition, really rolled out for 92, and everyone's sort of wondering what's Mohammed Abbas going to do on this. They could make Surrey follow on somehow here. And then I think Rory Burns hit him for 3 fours in his first over, and then that was almost a deficit gone.
Yeah, exactly.
Just on Burns, I've seen him a bit, obviously, at the Oval, and he's been scrabbling a bit, I think, but he looked really good. I thought he made 80. Yeah, he looked a bit stiller. I thought at the crease, the balance was there. He was taking it through mid-wicket comfortably. He wasn't falling over. The feet were going a bit better than they had been. And he looked like a test match opener again, you know. So it's good signs for a club that's been on its uppers, really, since the start of the season.
Yeah.
I'd echo that, because against Middlesex last week, obviously the story was not Rory Burns making 80 when Surrey sort of heroically squandered a position on day three. But he did look very good on the second day, I think, making 80-odd. So yeah, he does look like he's back in some sort of form.
Elsewhere, Glamorgan beat Kent in a low-scoring game at Cardiff. We've got a question directed more for you, Butch, I guess. Guy Fraser asks, I remember some batsmen with long careers, but with Stevens, Murta and Hogan all pushing 40 and taking, or passing 40 in some cases, and taking wickets, are there more bowlers lasting longer these days because maybe of sports science? Or was it always like this? Any crafty old bowlers Butch remembers facing past 40? Just on that game, Hogan, who turns 40 next month, he took a fifer, and so did Darren Stevens, who's 45.
I can't think of any, you know.
Caddick was 40-odd when he was still bowling, taking the new ball. Was Bickers, he? Yeah, Caddick, I think, retired
Bickers,
at 40.
Bickers wasn't 40.
Was he not?
No. Okay.
I'd add just on these three, I mean, Murta is just a freak, but he is definitely someone who knows, I don't know if it's sports science, but he knows how to manage himself. Like, sometimes he'll run up off like three steps and bowl it because he's kind of just trying to keep himself a bit fitter.
Pace-wise, no difference.
Yeah, exactly. Stevens and Hogan, though, are kind of special cases. I mean, Stevens didn't really bowl for Leicestershire much at all and took his first class five when he was 34. So he's almost like, now he's bowled the amount that a 35
year old he played when he was at Leicester. He played as a batter. He hardly bowled at all.
And Michael Hogan also, I think, so he played club or grade cricket, I guess they call it, in Australia for a long time, and then broke into first class cricket in England about the age of 28 or 29. So again, he's not got that, like, a great, you know, club cricket, you can bowl hard, bowl fast, but you're not bowling that 4 day sort of stretches that you would be in first class cricket.
I reckon that in the, you know, in the sort of the golden era of cricket, there would have been a hell of a lot more of them, you know, spin bowlers, etc. going on into their 40s. But no, I think this is slightly freakish.
Probably inevitable though as well, you know, with the game becoming more professionalized as well, that players will have little pockets where they can rest, and obviously the whole physiological side of the game is more advanced than it would have been maybe in the past. You're seeing it with Anderson at the top level.
Getting paid a few more quid also helps.
Yeah, totally.
Do you know, no, for sure. I mean, it's a little bit cynical, but you kind of the wages now that non-international players, you know, high value county players are on is a seriously good wage. So you kind of, you know, back in the old days, you might think to yourself, well, I could get another job and earn the equivalent and kind of, you know, not go through the pain and the torpor of it.
Even when you paid.
I mean, the money didn't start to get good for county players, for county only players until maybe 2003-04. You know, the salaries were pretty poor, really, up until that point. So, you know, you look at it that way, the incentive to stay fit, the incentive to keep going is much greater than it was in the past. So maybe we'll see more of them.
Yeah. The kind of erosion of motivation is a familiar story through all the years that I've been talking to cricketers about their internal stories. And that come the end days, what is it? Sometimes it's broken backs. Sometimes it's loss of form. A lot of the time it's, I just can't go anymore. I just can't keep going anymore.
The thought of, you know, seeing the cones out in the morning and
pre-season,
you're just like, oh, I'm not putting myself through that again. I still enjoy, you know, I enjoy certain bits of it, but there are certain bits I could seriously do without, and that's it. The curtain comes down.
Is there something, sorry, possibly in the new sort of structure of a county season where when you have the T20 blast played in a block, then, I mean, someone like Murta wouldn't be playing a huge amount of T20 cricket, I think. And even if he was, he's only bowling four overs every couple of days for, you know, a 3 week stretch, which gives you just that little bit of a break. So if something is building up and sort of like a stress issue, you get that kind of like that rest without even kind of realizing it as well, possibly. I mean, it's very much a theory, but
no, that's a fair point. It's a fair point. Elsewhere, a very impressive Durham side beat Warwickshire by an innings. It was good to see Mark Wood back taking wickets. Ben Rain took 5 for 9 in the first innings, but what caught my eye was Bryden Carse in the wickets again. He started the season really well. He's played for the Lions. He was on that Australia tour at the start of 2020, and he looks quite quick.
He is. I saw him live at Chelmsford second week of the season. He looks like a bowler who's going to take a lot of county wickets and a bowler who might possibly stand a chance of taking wickets at a high level as well. He has the frame, the physicality and from to the naked eye, enough nip and pace to be part of that conversation.
And he can bat as well. Very, very handy cricketer.
I think I said it a couple of weeks ago. I think they've probably pound for pound got the best seam attack in the country when everyone's fit, Durham. And they're creeping up on people again because obviously they've had 2 or 3 years with points deductions and the doldrums and
losing players.
But no, you can't keep a proper good cricket club down, you know, and it's a great fertile place for the game up there. And it's brilliant, really brilliant to see that they're on the way back.
If you just go through the Durham 11, it's just 11 very good cricketers. Totally. There's some very good bowlers aren't making that side as well. So yeah, keep an eye on them.
Lee's got runs as well. Who Boyk's picked him out as an England opener 7 or 8 years ago, as often happens. Wended his way through the back roads of the game and has now come back out and is going well again for Durham at the top of the order. No, it's good to see.
100%. Elsewhere, finally getting to what Ben wants to talk about.
Thank you. It's been 25 minutes.
Lanks chased down 253 in the fourth innings to beat Sussex as an unbeaten 90-odd for Keaton Jennings in the fourth innings. But Ben, what is your moment of the week?
Yeah, well, I guess the interesting thing about my moment of the week is that I actually only found out about it about 24 hours after it actually, or maybe even longer after it actually happened.
Just do your job, Sam.
Well, but this is the thing, is that, so I mean, because of the, you know, the righteous and correct social media blackout this weekend, it did sort of make you realise also just the value of those streams for, and the clips that they clip up for alerting you to these miraculous moments. So the moment is Matt Parkinson bowling another Warne-esque, just ridiculous ball to Delroy Rawlins, who'd been sort of taking the attack to him, really. I think he'd swept him for four twice in that over already. And then I actually then went back on the live stream to see what the setup was, and he'd bowled one ball the ball before, pitched in the exact same spot, but which was sort of flatter and just a little bit quicker.
But he's bowling over the wicket to a lefty.
Over the wicket to a lefty, yeah, and Rawlins had comfortably left it. Next ball is looped up, obviously he's put quite a lot more revs on it, and it's just the huge leg spinner, which kind of only Parkinson can bowl at the moment. Pitches in the rough, turns, and Darrow Rawlins goes to leave it, and it clips off stump, and he just looks there absolutely bemused at what's happened. We first found out about it because, have you got the name of the man who emailed us, Yaz?
Afraid I don't. But
thank you for emailing, because we'd obviously run a piece on Parkinson's other ball of the century a couple of weeks ago, and he said, I wonder if you might consider doing a piece about his wicket to his ball to Rawlins. So we went and looked at the highlights on Lancashire's YouTube, which had fewer than 1,000 views at the time, and were absolutely amazed by what we'd seen. And then 2 days later, when the blackout ends, Lancashire put it up, and then the whole internet goes crazy. That was the moment. And Parkinson is doing something incredible every game at this point. I mean, he was left out for the first game of the season.
It was incredible.
Second game, obviously, bowls the Rossington ball. Third game, takes 7 for 126 in 52 overs. And then now has done this to Delroy Rawlins. And I think he's got 20 wickets at 18 this season?
Yeah.
So the only three bowlers have taken more wickets at better average, and they're all seamers.
And they've all also played a game more than him as well.
Yeah, so he's having an amazing start to the season. And it kind of feels like, I personally, if England are thinking about picking Ollie Robinson with an eye to the Ashes for a test this summer, I would be very tempted to do the same with Parkinson. I think there's a real possibility that he could be a threat on those Australian pitches, and you, if possible, don't want him to be making his debut in that sort of circumstance. Sometimes you do get pitches in England which can require two spinners. We had one when India last toured. I think Mo came in, got recalled and took either 9 or 11 wickets, I think. And so if that's the case, I think I would like to see Parkinson, especially because if you're picking two spinners, you can afford for one to be that breakthrough bowler in England, the guy who you throw the ball to when nothing's really happening and you can see what happens. And even if there isn't a pitch, I think that a bit of rest and rotation for Leach, just see how Parkinson goes, I think could be a real viable thing that you can consider.
There's a lot made of how much he spins the ball. We've talked about that before. There's a lot made about how slowly he bowls the ball. But what I think is quite interesting is how much drift he gets and how late that drift is. Butch, how difficult is it if you're a batsman facing a spin bowler who just gets late drift? The wicket before the Rawlins one was an LBW, which on the surface didn't spin a huge amount, but it deceived the batsman in the drift, not necessarily the flight.
What that does is it changes it kind of, as the ball is on its way to you, it changes the position of your hips and the position of your shoulders. which then changed the angle that the bat starts to come down. So yeah, I mean that's one of the things that made Warne so difficult to face, was that the trajectory of the ball was changing as it was coming towards you, or at least the line of the ball. And as far as Mac Parkinson is concerned, the one thing that any spin bowler has control over, beyond anything else, beyond the magic deliveries, hard spun, you know, variation, whatever it is, one thing a spin bowler has control over, beyond conditions, beyond whether the pitch is going to turn or not, is where the ball is going to land, right? And if a spin bowler can have command over when the ball comes out of his hand, he knows where it's landing, and he has two or three different ways to get it to land in the same spot, then he's in the game. And what is happening with Matt Parkinson is that he has started to become very accurate. He's started to have control over where he is landing the ball. Once you've let go of the damn thing as a spin bowler, there is nothing more you can do. So you need to be in control of what happens when that thing comes out of your hand. Now, he has the ability to push them through a little bit flatter. He's never going to bowl the ball quickly as a leg spinner, and why should you? Warne very rarely bowled it quickly. But he now has the ability to change the speed and the flight on the delivery and have it land in the same spot. And if you can do that, you're in the game on any surface. And that's what we're seeing with him at the moment.
I think some of the kind of the way Parkinson is perceived, and the criticism he got when he played very briefly for England, was how differently he looks to a lot of other leg spinners at the moment. So if you compare him to Rashid, for example, Rashid's got a massive googly, and you see that loads. And as a casual fan, you can kind of go, oh, that's amazing. And you kind of lazily say, Parkinson's not got that. Can he survive? Oh, he bowls slightly slower, you know. Can he survive in international cricket? But, you know, actually, he's quite an old school leg spinner.
Yeah, and that doesn't necessarily stand him in good stead when it comes to perceptions built by coaches and commentators, because people look at the game now through the prism of one-day cricket. And spinners who bowl darts are often quite effective in one-day cricket. What's interesting about Parkinson, and this goes back to Butch's point about accuracy, Parkinson's wide ball record is outrageously good in both the forms. So what he's done, he has developed that innate accuracy, and he's deepened that over the years when he's not been allowed to play red ball cricket. So he's cut his teeth in white ball cricket, and now he's using all of those skills and that repetitive element of it, where you know where you're putting it. You can do it blindfolded because he's played a lot of white ball cricket. He's now bringing all of that stuff into the red ball game. And now you're starting to see the value of a bowler who is just who is in control of his length and his line. Now, Parkinson's a fascinating character, right? And you know, we talk about him on this show all the time. He's one of our
favorites.
You know,
him, Dan
one
Lawrence,
of our red flags.
Simon,
you know,
Jones.
We bring him up a lot. Yeah,
Dean Headley.
And the hobby horse.
We make no apologies for that, because he is almost unique in the story of English cricket as it stands currently. Now, when he first came into the England team, he bowls too slow. Moeen Ali got the same thing, incidentally, when he first came into the side. Different bowlers, though, requiring different skill sets. Parkinson has had to stand his ground on this. Now, I'm not saying that he's become pig-headed, and he recognises that there are times on certain tracks and against certain players to try and, you know, visit through a wee bit quicker. But he's had to stand his ground on that. And he said to us, and he said to others, if I sacrifice the things that make me good to bowl 3 or 4 mile an hour quicker to fit that bracket, to conform to that notion, then I'm not prepared to do that, because I don't want to lose what I've got. We talk about drift. The slower you bowl, but you do still have revs on it, the more drift you're going to get. Warne was proof of that. So fair play to him. Who knows where he's going to go? And talk about England is great and fun, but who knows? And we don't need to dwell too much on that just yet. But what he's done up to now in his career as a 23-year-old kid bowling leggers up in the Northwest, been an outstanding story so far. And it shows also that the boy's got a bit of gumption about him as well, you know, that he's not going to be pushed around. And you need that as a spinner. You know, you need flight and guile is one thing, but you need to have a strong shell as well, you know, because in English cricket, if you're trying to bowl wrist spin or finger spin, then it can be a hide into nothing. So look, fair play to him. I can't speak highly enough of him. Just one thing briefly. Yeah. I have one or two things that I like to ban in the magazine that I'm involved in. The word Orwellian, the word Shakespearean, and I'm now going to extend it to the word Warnesque. Right, Ben, don't take it personally. Right, but Warnesque. I'm just not having it anymore because it's too easy, isn't it? It's too easy. It's too easy just to make all those references back to that one freak genius.
Okay? Reminds me of Stuart McGill's
partner.
And
look, you described it beautifully and with great heart and obviously naturally articulate. But yeah, Warnesque. I'm putting my big red pen right through the word Warnesque.
It's quite Orwellian, if you feel.
Yeah, it probably is actually. Very good. All right, you win.
Excellent. We've actually got a bit of audio from the man himself. Parkinson spoke to Ben a couple of weeks ago now. Ben had to rush out of the podcast whilst recording to speak to Parkinson. There's a very nice interview that's written up on wisdom.com if you want to read that. But here is Parkinson on bowling those Warnesque deliveries and his excellent start to the season.
The first thing I thought was best to ask is if you could tell me the story of that ball as if you're telling it to like your grandkids in 50 years' time.
I'm going to try and say this better than I said on interview, which was, sack it, I'm just going to try and rip it. yeah, it was quite frustrating, actually. Obviously, I know Simon Kerrigan very well, and he was batting better than I've ever seen him bat, so I was getting more and more frustrated. Rossington had been playing really well as well. They'd both been sweeping from my outside leg stump, so I just thought, try and bowl it as fast as I could, really. If he'd have played it like he had been playing it, how he'd been sweeping, then I think he'd have been all right. But when he stayed back, I thought, oh, I'm in with a sniff here. And it must have literally just clipped the rough because there wasn't actually that much spin to the right-handers throughout the course of the game. But it must have literally just clipped the rough, and obviously to see it spin and hit off was fantastic. And then I came off at tee and my phone was absolutely blown up. It was all over Twitter and Instagram and stuff. So no, it was cool.
Yeah. You said you were nervous. Were you more nervous than you'd usually be at the start of a game because you hadn't played in a while and stuff?
No, not really. I just sort of backed sort of all the practice that I'd been doing. It was obviously having been away with England all winter and bowled 3 million overs in the nets. You sort of know where, but where you're at really. And there wasn't too big a transfer over from like the indoor school, for example, to the grass. For me, it was just literally crack on as usual. So I thought I bowled quite well in India and Sri Lanka. And then to come here, it was just mainly getting used to the Duke's ball again. Once I got used to that, then I was sweet. And the weather was nice. It was pretty warm. And yeah, as I said, it was nice in the nets for the past sort of 4 months. So I just took the confidence from there, really.
Yeah, you've mentioned the England stuff a few times. How did you find the trip as a whole? Was it basically just like a long spin camp, or what was it like?
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it, actually. I never thought of it like that. It was. It was a long trip. I like to think that I've improved as a bowler. I hope that people maybe saw that last week, or they will see it this season. Nice to get, as you said, a decent chunk of overs. I didn't have anywhere else to be. I got a lot of questions saying, could you not have come home and etc. But for me, the best place to be was with England, and I did the longest shift out there, which was nice as well. But yeah, as you said, just a long spin camp, surrounded by the best players, some of the best players in the world, the best players in the country. So there wasn't too many better places that I could have been to prepare me for the season. Obviously disappointed not to play at the end in the white ball. But any England side's tough to break into, especially that white ball side. So, yeah, there was obviously tough times on the trip as well. Being in a bubble for that long is quite tough. But I tried to stay positive. And as I said, there wasn't anywhere else I could have been. I'd either been in the indoor school at Old Trafford or bowling to Joe Root in India. I think it's a pretty easy decision.
What were your discussions with the Lancashire coaches and stuff like around then? Because as you say, you know, it's often been the case that you've been left out of teams, but this, when you've been bowling all winter and, you know, it's at the start of the season, you must have been raring to go.
Yeah, I was. There's some pretty honest conversations there. tough pill to swallow, really. I think it was a sort of, they weren't really sure how the pitch was going to play, and they probably hadn't seen enough of me either. Obviously, been away the whole winter, I hadn't been around, the coach hadn't seen me, and I think we only had two practice sessions in between me landing back and playing. So, yeah, obviously gutted at the time. When you take the emotion out, you can sort of see the thinking behind it. But yeah, just nice to sort of prove a point this week and then perform well.
Yeah. Do you think of yourself as a bowler that needs sort of a little bit from the pitch, or do you think that you can kind of do it whenever and also do a few types of roles as well?
I like to think that I can. I've probably not proven that I can yet, or I'll probably say I've not had the opportunity to prove that I can fulfil multiple roles, which is probably the main talking point for me with Lancashire at the minute, is trying to play as much cricket as I can to expose myself to sort of different situations, different pitches. So far in my career, I've tended to play mostly at home or on drier pitches. So that's probably the next stage of my development, is to try and sort of play when it is flat or green and do a job. But you can only play when you're selected, and you can only play the pitch in front of you. So for all my liking, they can make spinning pitches.
Yeah, and do you think, did it get sort of closer kind of over the winter? Because I don't actually know who you were bowling to in the nets as such. Were you bowling to the test squad, or were you kind of in your own thing separate way?
No, so we train with the test squad as normal. Like the 3 days out, and then we just like train as you would if you didn't play. So we bowled to a variety of players, really. Bowled a lot to James Bracey, and then rest of the squad really during the week. So we'd have sort of 3 days on, then we'd have the first 2 days of the test off. We'd be at the hotel, and then we'd be in doing 12 man for the three other days. Or, well, I think one game lasted 2 days, so we weren't in at all that week. But yeah, it was good fun, real challenge. They're a great set of batters. So I think you can take a lot of confidence from that when you bowl and you gradually see improvements. You start thinking, oh, I'm looking more threatening, or he's not playing a certain shot against me now. And then when you come and play for Lancashire, you think, oh, because I've put all these hours of work in against the very best, I think it sets you up nicely.
Yeah, that was the only thing I was going to ask, is what specifically were you working on out there? Was it anything technical, or was it just getting loads of overs in, or what was it?
We varied, really. So I've been working on a couple of little minor technical things, been working on my googly, bit more like trying to direct, bit more direct, or have it in me to bowl a little bit quicker without losing any of the skills that I've got. But you sort of varied because of where we were and the way the series were going, with things off the field as well, COVID and etc., you actually never felt that far away from playing. You thought, I'm only one injury away potentially from playing. So you couldn't sort of veer too far away from your actual basics that you knew you could go out and deliver. So you had to find like a fine balance between, right, today I'm going to prepare as if I'm going to play the next test, or today I'm going to prepare as if I'm not playing till April. And that got easier as we got on. Obviously, when Mo got COVID, it was all a bit up in the air. And as the series wore on, you sort of got the realisation that you weren't going to get called up unless there was a freak injury. And that's when you could revert back to working on some things that weren't quite as strong.
You've got a pretty formidable record, really. Like, your first class bowling average, what, under 25 now? Like, white ball numbers are all pretty good, or really good. So what I was wondering more is how you kind of feel about, like, especially when you made your debut in New Zealand and you had a few people kind of saying, like, looks really good, looks like he's got, you know, natural talent, but he's going to need to bowl quicker if he's going to make it. And if that's kind of just frustrating to hear, like almost like dismissed basically by some people, and how you kind of react to that, I guess.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. I probably learned a good lesson actually in South Africa, because I remember in New Zealand, I bowled, obviously they said it was like the slowest, and that was quite embarrassing actually, the slowest ball in Crickviz database, which is a real kick in the teeth. But no one really mentioned it in a negative light in New Zealand because I did well, whereas didn't go as well in South Africa. And that's all of a sudden everyone was saying, need to bowl quicker, et cetera, et cetera. And I probably thought too much about that in South Africa. And then again, at the start of last summer when I came back from injury, And then I just sort of went, you know what, I'm just going to go back to doing what I do. And if that's not good enough, then it's obviously not good enough. And I'll just try and keep performing well and just see what happens. I think the winter I've just had not playing actually gave me a bit of time to think, right, this is how we can do it, and not I'm going to just rush it and try and make it match ready. I can just actually slowly build, have good days, have bad days. And I'd like to get to the point where people say, yeah, he bowls slowly, but he can still be effective on any surface. And that's probably the main challenge. I know I can be effective in England. It's just whether that translates to being effective in India, in New Zealand, in Australia. And I think that's probably that, as I said, similarly with Test cricket, it's you'll only know when you get given an opportunity to play. And people will only know then. And I guess that's probably why I'm a bit more sort of chilled about it, or probably not worried about it too much, because I guess I haven't played. So until I play, I don't know the answer to that question.
Elsewhere in the championship, Somerset had another narrow win over Middlesex, this time winning by 4 wickets. Abby Slade asks, what do you make of Lewis Goldsworthy's debut for Somerset against Middlesex? Goldsworthy is a 20-year-old all-round who scored 39 in the first innings and 41 not out in the second innings. I watched a bit of that game, thought he batted very nicely. He was at the Under-19 World Cup last year that I watched a lot of. And he actually impressed more with the ball. He bowls left-arm spin. So genuinely the player he reminds me of is Liam Dawson, which might not be the most exciting thing in the world, but Liam Dawson-esque. Dawson is a very, very good cricketer. Ben?
Yeah, well, because England don't have a huge amount of white ball finger spinners coming through. I mean, Dawson has not got the chance perhaps he should have, and Monan has kept his spot for perhaps longer than he deserved in ODI cricket, certainly, because there hasn't been that person banging down the door. So when we picked our 2023 World Cup squads on wisden.com, not long after the 2019 World Cup, I think, it must have been early last year.
All good content.
Yeah, I included Lewis Goldsworthy in mine as a punt, so I'm claiming it now, even if he never scores another run.
Four days into his first class career.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yeah.
Love that.
Phil, you were at New Road. Talk us through it.
Yeah. Well, not much to say. I feel sorry for the groundsman, because the grounds was underwater until 7 weeks ago. How do you produce a track? And it was bleak and placid.
It's the Essex game.
Worcester, Essex. Essex batted first. Everyone got a few. Cook got 100. He's good. He's a good player. Wesley got another 100. He now averages something like a million and a half against Worcester. Dan Lawrence got 90. Gave it away again. Never mind. Moving on. Anyway, they got 500 and loads, and Worcester then followed on, but did so very, very slowly. And in the end, it was a sort of miserable bore draw. I have to admit, I didn't go on the Sunday. I had better things to do. But I did go on the Saturday and stuck it out. And it's strange, because it's been such a vibrant start to the summer. And this was the other side of the coin, without fans in. And at the start of the summer, when, you know, pitches are a bit dead and it was very cold and all of that. And this was kind of the other side of it, you know. In a way, it was reassuring to see a bit of a dead game and people just sort of desperately trying to create something from nothing, you know.
Do you think there's any part of Dan Lawrence's mind when he's trudging off, when he gives it away on 90, that he thinks,
Lawrence Claxton.
You know, how's Phil going to feel about this?
I doubt it. I don't think I occupy much of his consciousness. It was interesting, though, because I was talking to Mags, the coach, McGrath, and he was saying, look, he could have had 500s this year. As it is, he's got none. And I say, is this indicative of anything? He said, nah, I don't think so. He said, you know, he'll be kicking himself on a couple of occasions, but I look at how he's playing. I look at how dominant he is when he's out there. And he said that, you know, the big ones will come. We shall see. But anyway, that was me. That was my weekend.
Excellent. We've got a question that's loosely based around the county championship, looking ahead to the start of the test summer. Will Yates asks, the vast majority of players making serious runs in the championship at the moment are either capped or overseas or not really been in the reckoning at all. And the England batting unit has looked fairly settled, rotations notwithstanding, over the past 12 to 18 months. Who is England's next top six test debutant, and when/what would it take for them to get a nod? Who wants to go first on that?
I think it looks most likely to be James Bracey. I mean, he's the one that they obviously already really liked him and what they see. We talked about him quite a lot on the pod already, but already rated him because they called him up for that that training camp on not much evidence. And then he made runs in that warm-up game, which made people take notice. And then he's been with them all winter. They'll have seen what he's about. And now he's finally getting the returns that justifies that kind of that faith. If I had to look ahead to the start of the season from now, I mean, Zach Crawley hasn't got a run this season. He's got 160 odd, and that's about it. And he didn't have a great winter.
Zach Crawley will be batting at number three in the first Test match.
No, I'm sure he will. But I think, I mean, you know,
you have written him off before in this podcast.
Sure, but we have also seen young cricketers come in and do very, very well, and then struggle after that. I mean, we've seen it with Haseeb Mameed, who looked to not just have at that point to have the technique, he also looked to have the temperament, and then.
Zach Crawley will be batting at number three for England.
Sure.
But I'll get flashbacks to last summer here. Oh, and that was fun.
And yeah,
his first class average is dangerously close to that 30 mark.
Yeah, this is if this is what prods him into getting a 267 next week again, then it'll be worth it for English cricket.
Ben's written you off again, Zach.
No, I mean, I think that Zach Crawley will have a very long and very good test career, and I think that that could also include being left out early on when he's not in his best form, because he is a player who's going to come in and out of form until...
One more time? Yeah, look, I said Bracey in the last magazine. I said it a couple of weeks ago. I think if you are looking for an uncapped player, then I think he's probably at the front of the queue, and he's versatile. He can bat, he can open, he could bat three... He could bat more in the middle order as well, and they like his style. He's smart
he has the added advantage of having been in and around the squad and the team and the now head of selectors, head coach, head of laundry, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean that is an advantage. I mean, uncapped is quite a tricky one, isn't it? Because the people we've been talking about have had a little bit of a go.
Yeah.
Previously. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I would be very surprised if we saw a debutant in the top six this summer or winter, to be honest with you. But James Bracey is as good a shout as any.
Last week, we talked a lot about the possibility of the IPL being suspended this year, given the COVID situation in India. That did happen this week. I'm not going to talk about it too long because we talked about it a lot on last week's show. But long story short, a couple of KKR players tested positive for COVID-19 on Monday, causing the postponement of KKR's game against RCB. It was then reported that three members of the CSK support staff also tested positive on the same day. Then yesterday, after further positive tests in various camps, the tournament was postponed, with the IPL releasing a statement that said, "These are difficult times, especially in India, and while we have tried to bring in some positivity and cheer, however, it is imperative that the tournament is now suspended and everyone goes back to their families and loved ones in these trying times." It was interesting that that's what the statement actually said, because I think a lot of people assume that, oh, they'll try and squeeze the whole tournament into a week in Mumbai or something. But that's obviously not the case. Phil, you spoke to Chris Wokes over the weekend, who was there before the tournament was cancelled.
Yeah, one of cricket's more vibrant and bubbly characters, and, you know, glass half full kind of bloke. It wasn't half full when I spoke to him. Maybe that's me. But he
saw your caller ID.
Yeah. So here we go.
You started talking about the Worcester Essex games at New Road.
If he brings up Dan Lawrence one more time.
He used an interesting term. He said, look, I can't complain. When I look at what's happening outside my hotel room and I'm in here and I feel safe and obviously I'm being well paid to play cricket, he said, I'm not going to complain. What he did say, though, is that this is self-inflicted, and I thought that was an interesting use, and he used that phrase two or three times. And I felt sorry for him, because on a human level, I mean, he misses his wife and kids desperately. He says he'd now adjusted his body clock, so he'd be awake when they awake and he'd go to sleep when they go to sleep. So he was on UK time, stuck in a hotel room with this humanitarian catastrophe taking place outside, and on his TV screens he'll be reminded of it every minute of the day. And that is a desperate place for anyone to be in. So while he stopped short of saying, "I need to get home," you could sense that in the conversation that we had, and I think he will be immensely relieved, just like I think everyone else will. And as Butch said last week, as soon as it infiltrated that bubble, and as soon as a player or two and a support staffer or two got infected, then they had to do the thing. I mean, it arguably should have happened before that.
I mean, you know, I forgot when I was leaving the ground last week, I forgot about, you know, how big a production these things are. You know, cameramen, you've got sort of, you know, guys, riggers, you've got truck, you've got this, the amount of people that it takes just to put on one of these games on one evening is huge. And trying to keep them, you know, this is absolutely ripping through the country. To sort of think that you could continue and keep everybody sort of separate from it is just extraordinary, really. And I was sort of torn with the idea that perhaps that sort of the entertainment and the fact that cricket is so big over there sort of tempers the temptation to call it disgusting and all the rest of it, because at least they were trying to provide some cheer and some entertainment. But there was no way. There was just simply no way. And then you sort of throw it forward and think, well, they're going to want to try and finish it, but how? You got World T20 in October, India touring England late June through to August. All of the international teams will be in the midst of their preparations for that World T20. I just cannot. You know, where are you going to slide it in?
And then you've got the Ashes about less than a month
off. Precisely. I mean, you know,
it throws more shade on the schedule itself as well, of course. You know, I mean, it's an unintended consequence of this, but...
Well, I mean, look, you know, the IPL had already, you know, we kind of forget that the IPL was already muscled into a part of the schedule that had hitherto been blank. Yeah. You know, we've come to expect and know that is going to be a part of the cricketing calendar now, but it wasn't only 13 years ago, 14 years ago. Yeah.
Money doesn't talk, it swears, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, I don't call any sort of moral judgment on that fact, but there is no room anymore for anything, anywhere.
Yep.
And sometimes you just got to go, look, the situation at the moment is very dire. It's very it's not hopefully something that we're going to see repeated in our lifetime. And that sometimes you just have to go,
yeah,
you know what, that's it. It's done. We can't. There's nothing we can do. Totally. We'll take it on the chin and we'll go again next year.
Yeah, and I hope that does happen and that the calendar isn't more kind of bastardized because commerce is such that this has to be finished and they have to have a 2021
IPL.
If we go down that road, that is a grim state of affairs.
And we've done this, you know, England and Australia did this. We're trying to fit in extra Ashes series because of the World Cup in 2015. We've seen what happens. We've seen the sort of the unintended consequences of trying to squeeze things where they do not belong and the knock-on effect that has all around the world of cricket, not just in the countries that are directly involved. And so I think sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and say, you know what, we'll take the hit this time, yep. and we'll leave everything as it is. Let everybody have a breather. I mean, the metaphorical idea of gasping for breath. The calendar is gasping for breath, and India is gasping for breath.
Yeah, we had the journalist Rory Dollard on the show when the England South Africa tour was canned, and he basically made the point there is just no room to get this tour back into the calendar. And there's been some kind of slightly, well, very distasteful kind of people on social media saying, oh, the bubble wasn't good enough, and people saying, comparing the quality of various bubbles that have been taking place in the world. And Ben and I, we talked about this before, about how basically since the start of the pandemic, the only bubbles that have really worked have been in places where there hasn't been that much COVID at the end of the day. yes. Like however good the bubble is, if it is so dependent on the situation, and as we all know, the situation in India is as bad as it's been anywhere else in the world throughout the whole pandemic.
And sorry, just on that, because it seems plausible that how Varun Chakravarty, who I think was the first player to test positive, got the caught the virus, was that he needed a scan in his shoulder, and they had sort of protocols in place for how to take players out of the bubbles. You know, the player gets in full PPE. The driver gets in full PPE. They drive them to a hospital, which sort of have this little they'd sort of self-contain the unit, they clean everything down, and the, you know, the medical staff are wearing full PPE. But this is a virus that passes through the air, and you can't, you know, completely fully seal off the clothes that you're wearing as much as you'd like to. All you're doing is playing a game of odds, and the odds are just so much worse when, you know, it's ripping through the country.
And that in itself, just think about that. That all the resources that had to be taken up and used for one person to go to leave the bubble to get tested.
From the knock-on effect.
So that's for one person. Yeah. And you think about the humanitarian struggle that's going on with people that have no access to anything whatsoever, and yet all of that resource is taken up for one guy in the tournament itself. It's the only decision that could have been taken. And some might say that it's a week too late. There's no point spreading blame around. It's happened. It's the right thing. And you just pray that they get things under control there, regardless of the IPL.
Mm. Yep. Before it was canned, there's one amazing innings from Joss Butler that I think a lot of English fans have enjoyed. He's not been in great form recently.
You remember the week, right?
It was. He was 34 off 32, I think. And he looked as he made batting look really difficult in the first half of that innings. And then nine overs later, he walks off the field with the eighth highest score in IPL history, having hit 90 odd off 30 in the last nine overs.
He now has as many T20 hundreds as Alastair Cook and Cheshwar Pujara.
So. Yes, as he mentioned in the post match interview as well, which was nice. We've had some Test cricket as well this week. Sri Lanka beat Bangladesh in the second and final Test of that series, and there were hundreds for Karunaratne and Thirumane, who's on an amazing run of form.
Is he up averaging over 25 now?
He is. Yeah, is he? He is. He's about 28, and that's after averaging 60. For five or six tests.
Yeah.
There are 11.
I think he's a really good player. It's staggering that his record was so bad.
Yeah, in the England tour.
Such a long series of space of time.
On the England tour of Sri Lanka, I was thinking, like, I can kind of see why they've given him this many opportunities. Because when you look at his record, like, you know, he's played 35 tests and averaged 23, give up. But you can see why, and it is actually paying off.
And they're not spoilt for choice at the moment.
Yeah, that's true.
That's another part.
Although this was a pretty good win for them, and I guess the other big positive was there are 11 wickets on debut for 22-year-old left-arm spinner Praveen Jayawickrama, which, Lasith Mbeldinia did very well against England, so their spin stocks looks very good once more. And in Zimbabwe, Pakistan beat Zimbabwe by an innings. There was 100 for Fahad Alam, and lots of wickets for Hassan Ali, who is making a real resurgence recently. Having had a couple of difficult years in international cricket.
Fahad Alam has taken a record off Ravi Bapara, Phil.
Yeah, which you told me about last week. So 300s, no 50s.
That's Bapara, and Alam is 400s, no 50s. No. So there you go.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah. Go big or go home.
Phil, what's your moment of the week?
It's got to be a conversation with Graham Gooch, professor of run making. And we had a chat two mornings ago, maybe, or maybe yesterday morning.
I think it was yesterday.
It was yesterday morning. 8 o'clock in the morning, he was already out, up and about, striding across the Devon Moors. He's there with his family on a walking holiday. And it was meant to be a quick chat. It meant to simply just be a few recollections of the 91 Leeds innings, the famous 154 against the West Indies when he carried his bat. Instead, it became more of a seminar on the art and science of making runs, not scoring runs, making runs.
Very important to make that distinction. Yeah.
And it was full of all the beautiful Goochisms that we've come to know and love. And it is a strange experience. And I don't know him well at all. Obviously, Mark will know him much better. But I've watched him since I was a child, first of all, in the flesh at Chelmsford. And then I've bumped into him once or twice. He has a very clear memory of those occasions, which is not a reflection of me, but just a reflection of, I know, oddly enough.
That's really
I think it's a reflection
strange.
Of the way that his mind works. I mean, he's so immersed in the game. He'd already had a phone call with Paul Grayson that morning, because he was running Yorkshire 2s, playing at Billericay against Essex. And this was only 8 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday morning. Anyway, the point is that he is so forever immersed in the game, and that comes through. And yet you have this conversation with this fella, and you have to check yourself sometimes, because he scored more professional runs than any other human being who's ever walked the earth. You know, you can have Jackie Hobbs. You can have Graham Hick.
You can have Sachin.
You can have whoever you like. Gooch has scored the most professional runs in history, in human history. And so when he starts talking about it, you do have to pinch yourself a little bit. And then you hear the kind of the whistling wind come across, Buffett in on the phone call, and you can just picture him, you're like Jude the Obscure on the Devon Moors. And it's just a strange, slightly surreal experience. But he automatically starts talking about batting and the science of batting. And he makes this clear distinction between scoring runs and making runs. He said scoring runs, he actually said, you can score runs. I mean, I didn't tell him I'm not a bad player. He said, even you can score runs. He said, it's your day, the sun's out, you get a bit of luck, it's a flat pitch, you score 100. But making runs, there's a distinction there, there's a difference. Making runs is when none of those things are in your favour, but you do it anyway. And it's an interesting kind of key distinction in how he sees the mysteries of making runs. He also spoke about a few experiences of his own. And we spoke about 91 in particular, but we also spoke about 81 as well, when he made 100 at Barbados in the shadow of Kenny Barrington's desperate heart attack overnight. And Gooch made 100 then, and he became quite choked up, actually, in recalling that moment, 40 years on, and yet still a very raw experience for him. And he was saying it wasn't that he had an added incentive, because he never needed an incentive to go out and bat, but he said, the trauma of that moment gave him an edge, and I thought that was an interesting term, again, that he used. And I kind of got a little glimpse of the emotional side of this kind of Mount Rushmore figure in the game, you know. He spoke about 91 and he spoke about playing and missing. He said there's an art and a skill to playing and missing. He says if you've got good technique, if you hold the line, if your balance is right, and if you're not going too early at the ball, then you will play the line and you won't follow it. And he says, it's a hard mental skill, but if you have good technique, then you can play and miss and put it away. You can put it to one side. He says, players with chinks in their technique, that they're likely to go looking for that ball that jags away. And of course, there were 100 balls that jagged away at Headingley, overcast, in 91. He also spoke about, and this was fascinating to me, he spoke about playing the hook shot, and he played a lot of hook shots in that particular innings. He said there was no way I was going to play a drive because it was going everywhere under, you know, leaden skies, blah, blah, blah. He said, but if they bowled it short, I would play the hook shot, but only at certain points in the innings. And he said that he would always know if Malcolm Marsh was running into bowl, or if Kirtley's running into bowl, or Kirtley never bowled you, but, you know, bouncer or long on, but he would know before the ball is let go if he's going to play the hook shot or not. And he said any batsman who turns around and says, well, you know, I saw it pitch and then I saw it climb and then I decided to play the shot. He quote, you've got to be an effing good player to play like that. So when Gooch says it, you kind of go, oh, right, interesting. And what his point was that it would always be a decision, a pragmatic decision based on pitch, pace, new ball or old ball, whether there's a man out or whether there's an offside field, whether it's a shot to nothing or not, and so on and so on. And it's just a little glimpse again into how you play at that level, at that real level. And I hadn't heard too many people talk about that particular element, that hook shot, because again, there's a lazy cliche that I've probably fallen into, that it's a bit of it's a compulsive shot, it's an impetuous shot, you see it, you hit it. Well, in his mind, and obviously I'm coming to you now, in his mind, that notion is completely alien to him, and he also doesn't buy it when players say that they do play it like that.
Interesting.
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think because of how great he was, the rules kind of don't apply elsewhere. You know, that's what made him so great. He was able to sort of break everything down into these small compartments. I mean, the thing that really interested me about what you just said, it's not about playing the hook shot or not. Because for me, I was always thinking, I'm not going to play it. And then I would play it and surprise myself. Right. So, you know, that's completely goes against. But then, you know, my record, 34, average 34, whatever, 800s versus his is, you know, there's the comparison in itself. Was the thing about Kenny Barrington. Now, for me, the difference between those who are the great players and those who are good, but not in that way sort of reliable, I suppose. And that's what separates the great from the good, is the kind of the sheer consistency that they were able to go out there, make runs, come hell or high water. It was this idea that something as traumatic as that, he was able to not only compartmentalize and keep away from his thought processes, but he was actually able to turn that into something good.
Yeah.
That staggers me.
Yeah, totally.
And there you have it. There you have the sort of, that's the difference. You know, I found it incredibly difficult in my career as a professional player to be able to leave, if stuff was bad off the field, away from the game of cricket, to be able to leave that behind to a sufficient degree to be able to then give enough of myself to the job that I was doing as a player. I found that unbelievably hard. But somebody like Alex Stewart was very, very good at being able to put aside personal issues and go out there and play the game as though nothing was going on. And Gucci obviously was an absolute master. In fact, he not only ignored it, he used it to his advantage. That's staggering to me. Cricket being the length of time that it takes to make a test match 100, the length of time that it takes to play a test match, means that life that is going on in and around the game of cricket is not a diversion. It's kind of, you're in it.
Yeah.
All of it is happening at the same time. And so being able somehow to put enough of it away that it doesn't affect what you're doing in the job, and then being able to go back to it, and then being able to go back to the job, is an incredible skill. And those that have scored a gazillion runs, you know, somebody like Sachin, imagine his mental capacity for compartmentalization. It must be incredible. And that is the stunning bit of your revelations about Chat with Gucci.
That's what really, really separates them, I think. And the eternal mysteries of it all, you know, unraveled just that little bit more on the back of a half hour conversation, and you know, then he hung up, and then he'd be speaking to someone else 5 minutes later, you know, and it's that kind of immersion in the game as well that I find very interesting and kind of beautiful as well in its own way.
Do you know something about, because Gucci was batting coach for England, he was kind of standing head coach for a little while in 1999 as well, and I always found him quite frustrating to talk to about batting, because he was very good at telling you the what, but we're not very good at telling you the why or the how. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not criticising, I think he's a terrific bloke and obviously an incredible player. But he would say stuff like, you know, well, hit it back where it's come from, or hit it to mid off and mid on. I'm like, well, I bloody well know that. I know where I'm supposed to be hitting it, but I can't get it there. Every time I aim it through mid on, it goes through square leg. You know, how? Why? You know.
Mm.
And you know, so that was, you know, perhaps, you know, I know Cookie has done an enormous amount of work with Graham and swears by his coaching methods, but for me, I was left frustrated. Every time I was like, well, why are you telling? I know that.
Yeah.
I know this stuff.
Yeah.
But I can't do it. I can't put it into practice at the moment. Why am I not able to do so?
Just another tiny bit, just to get on the psychology of it. It reminded me of a quote that NASA once gave about Gooch. And NASA was in the midst of one of his NASA moments, and it was all getting too much for him. And he turned to Gooch, almost frustrated, and he said, why don't you get effing nervous? What's the matter with you? And Gooch just turned to him and said, as he's just putting his bat down and, you know, re-stickering his pads on the Velcro and everything very just so, he says, it's just a game of cricket, NASA. It's just a game of cricket. Which, again, is interesting because it's, on the one hand, a game of cricket, but on the other hand, it's everything. It's life. it's what Gooch is.
I was going to say, I think one of the amazing things about that is just the level of detail and the passion he has on batting so long after he finished his career. Like, I think a lot of people probably would leave that to one side to a degree. And also, we were talking earlier about, given that he's on the Mount Rushmore of English cricket batting, etc.
Might do that in the magazine.
Yeah.
Might look quite nice.
It's a good little feature. Wow, yeah. Good little feature. Given he's on that, I think kind of like the way he almost carries himself, almost in the way he lived his life post his playing career, kind of, you know, in Indian cricket, Sachin is on another level. You don't really see him that often. But with Gooch, you see him in a tracksuit at Chelmsford when they were playing in Div 2, for example, which almost clouds your judgment of kind of what he achieved as a player.
Well, again, I used to see him in Marks and Sparks on the high street at Chelmsford all the time with his missus. And he was always in the Whittingdale 1993 shell suit of the India tour. And I remember that because I kind of quite fancied that when I was 12 year old. And he'd just sort of be sort of gooching around in Marks and Sparks. And I'm thinking, hold on, you've scored more runs than anyone else in history. And there you are, plodding through Marks and Sparks. Anyway, Anyway, moving on.
Anyway,
that was my moment of the week.
Wonderful. I think that's it for the show. Well, cheers, Phil. Cheers, Pleasure. Ben. Cheers, Books. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you've liked what you've listened to or watched, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.
Podcast Network.